Good evening. It is Monday, December 2nd. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Well, as President Trump heads to London for the NATO summit, National Health Service workers in London will be leading a protest of tens of thousands outside Buckingham Palace, and Prime Minister Boris Johnson is pleading with Trump not to wade into British politics. Can Trump show restraint and discipline and abide by Boris Johnson's requests? Well, for insight into all of this, we turn to my first guest. He's a London-based writer on international affairs with a special interest in Russia and law. He is Alexander Mercuries. Alexander, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Absolutely delighted to be with you again.
So, U.S. President Trump is on his way to the NATO summit in London as we speak, where he is under pressure from Prime Minister Boris Johnson to resist the temptation to wade into the looming British election. For example, Trump has shown no restraint in pushing for Britain's exit from the European Union and critiquing the politicians involved in the long-running Brexit debate. Your thoughts on this?
Well, it is not surprising. Firstly, I should say that Boris Johnson and Donald Trump have in recent months become quite firm political allies. But the British electorate, the British people, do not like Donald Trump at all. He is extremely unpopular here. I was looking at some of the opinion poll surveys, and I mean, they put his unpopularity at anywhere between 60 to 80% of Britons don't like him. So, I mean, he is deeply unpopular here with most British people. He is obviously seen as a sort of extremely right-wing, very belligerent, aggressive, corrupt, racist, all those sort of things, which are not popular with most British people. But there is also a great fear amongst a lot of British people that Boris Johnson and the Conservatives, as part of their Brexit policy, will seek, once Britain is out of the European Union, to negotiate very closely with Trump a deal whereby we replace our long-standing commercial and economic relations with Europe with the United States instead. And that could result in U.S. insurance companies and other companies and medical providers starting to work their way into the British National Health Service. Britain has a socialized medical service, health service, of which it is extremely proud. Britons look at the medical system in the United States with complete horror. Any suggestion that that might be exported here as part of a Brexit, post-Brexit deal with the United States is going to be deeply unpopular. So for all these reasons, the British would not want to see too close relations with the United States, and any connection between Boris Johnson and Donald Trump that sort of gives force to any of these fears is something that the Conservatives will want to avoid at all costs whilst the election is underway.
So do you see the projected protest of tens of thousands of National Health Service workers outside of Buckingham Palace? Do you see that materializing in the numbers that are projected?
Yes, I think there will be a big protest. I mean, always one has to wonder whether, you know, those sort of numbers will come out, given that the weather in London is very cold and very dark. And that always deters people from protesting. But I come back to what I said. He is very unpopular here. The fact that he has already spoken of Boris Johnson as his friend has not helped Boris Johnson at all. And I think Boris Johnson wants to keep as big a distance from Donald Trump during the election as possible. It's going to be a very interesting NATO summit. Donald Trump obviously is here. Boris Johnson, who has all sorts of trust issues, and he's a notoriously poor manager, is going to be in charge. So many people are asking, what could possibly go wrong? It's the kind of thing where a disaster seems to be round the corner. We'll see whether the party managers are able to prevent it.
Over this past weekend, Jack Merritt, age 25, and Saskia Jones, 23, were stabbed to death by Usman Khan, convicted of terrorism in 2012. This was unfortunate on the London Bridge at a prisoner rehabilitation event. What's been the effect of this event on the polls, on Boris Johnson, as elections draw near?
It's interesting because, of course, so far we've not had many opinion poll readings, but I'm going to make a guess, which is that, in fact, and contrary to what you might expect, the polls will either change very little, or if they do, they will go against Johnson's way. The point about it is that this particular prisoner was released on early release. Boris Johnson is the Prime Minister. The Conservative government has been in office for 9 years. It does not have a good reputation for its law and order policies. They're seen as being both too harsh in some respects and too soft in others, and it's got a difficult relationship with the police. Many people will see this as a symptom of the fact that the Conservatives, whilst in office, have run down the police, run down the civil service, run down the prison service, and are not keeping proper control of these prisoners who are being released early and who are carrying out these things. I think that is going to be a much more powerful issue, in other words, against the Conservatives, than the usual Conservative attempts to say, you know, Labour is soft on terrorism and is keen on Islamic terrorists and all that sort of thing. I think that that will more probably play against the Conservatives than for them. But I don't expect it to shift many votes.
Has Prime Minister Johnson's response to this tragedy been too simplistic? He seems to be focusing on sentencing when discussing the implications of the terror attack at the London Bridge. Is he ignoring the wider range of factors, many of which you've just articulated, that could have had an impact on this tragic event?
Absolutely, because, of course, in a sense, he's on the defensive, because this has happened, as I said, after the Conservatives have been in office for 9 years. There is another overarching issue, which is actually an important issue for many people in Britain, because many people in Britain, and Jeremy Corbyn is one of them, argue that one of the reasons why there has been this rise in Islamist terrorism, not just in Britain, but around the world, is because of the foreign policies that have been followed for a very long time, which have been very belligerent and very aggressive, and which have created lots of trouble and chaos in the Muslim world, and which have sown strong anti-Western feeling here. Now, that's not the kind of argument that ever seems to carry much traction in the United States. Britain is different from the United States, and there are a lot more people who think this way in Britain than there are, I think, in the United States. Jeremy Corbyn, one of the reasons he is a popular or has been a popular candidate, one of the reasons he is the Labour Party candidate is because the Labour Party leader is because he has opposed these wars, predicting that they would result in more terrorism. Now, we had terrorist incidents last time there were elections in Britain in 2017. Corbyn made exactly those points, and they carried traction then. A surprisingly large section of the electorate was actually agreeing with him on these issues. And I suspect, again, the same thing will happen this time.
Is it too simplistic for me to draw some correlations between the protests that are anticipated with the National Health Service workers and the austerity measures that have impacted the police, prisons, and probation, basically looking at the privatization and the impact that austerity has had on budgets as it relates to prisons and probation and police? To me, I see these as different elements of the same neoliberal policies that are being employed or trying to be employed in London and that are being employed in the United States and are also being employed in other countries around the world?
It is not too simplistic at all. In fact, it is exactly right. The remarkable thing is that even the Conservatives now have very grudgingly and frankly, unconvincingly sort of come round to accepting the fact that austerity, as it is called, neoliberal or neoconservative, ultra-free market, corporatist privatization policies, which is what they really are, that they have actually had a really, really damaging effect, that they've hollowed out services, that they've left police, health service, all of these vital services in a very bad shape. And I should add that as we are speaking, there are strikes underway by university workers all over the country because they feel that the university system is under extreme stress because of the history of these policies. This election is going to turn on two issues. It's the very great concern lots of people have in Britain about all of this. All of these issues, the effect of austerity, the desire to reverse austerity, the desire to take Britain forward in a particular way that goes against all of that. Those sort of people will be drawn towards Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party. Then there is the other part of the British electorate who are basically focused around Brexit and its issues. They voted for Brexit in 2016, partly, by the way, in many cases, because they saw that as a protest against these same policies, which they identified with an establishment that for them included the European Union. And many of those people are drawn to the fact that Boris Johnson promises to see Brexit done. It's very interesting that he doesn't actually propose very much else, except very on the margins. He too is offering to spend more money on vital services. So in a sense, not only is your argument absolutely not simplistic and the correct one, but it is one that I think in Britain is now largely accepted.
Final question for you in terms of the NATO summit that is scheduled to start Tuesday in London, Turkey coming to the NATO summit. Your thoughts on how Erdogan will be received and how some of these issues might or might not be addressed in the couple of days when they'll all be there?
Well, it is a very unhappy alliance, and I think that Erdogan has maneuvered himself into a position now where his priority is to show to the Turkish people that he will stand up for Turkish national interests, that they don't feel any affinity for NATO anymore, as they used to do, as I remember that they used to do. I used to know Turkey quite well. And I think that that's a country that, in a way, has become semi-detached from Turkey, but from NATO. But if you're talking about the rest of the alliance, I think that without any very great conviction and without any very great belief, it will tinker along, at least for a while. The various deep states around Western Europe and in North America, if I use that phrase, I think remain very committed to it. I think it is still a nice system for some people to meet up, to say horrible things about the Russians and, of course, to get lots of money through arms contracts. And, of course, it serves some people's geopolitical interests. It serves American geopolitical interests by holding down Europe. It serves British geopolitical interests because it makes Britain seem more important than it really is.
Alexander Mercury's, man, that was fabulous analysis, as always. Thank you so much for your time and your contribution to the Critical Hour.
Thank you very much for having me on your program, and I look forward to being on it again soon.
Thank you very much. Folks, you're listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. So, President Trump criticizes Democrats for planning hearings while he meets with NATO leaders, while his counsel says that he won't participate in House Judiciary impeachment panels, calling them unfair. What are we to make of all of this? Well, for insight, let's turn to my next guests. First, he's a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War, Daniel Lazar. Daniel, as always, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And you're also the author of the latest piece in the weeklyworker.co.uk entitled Most Dangerous Woman in America, Fiona Hill. And we'll talk about that in the context of this as well. We're also joined by a professor of political science at Hamline University and author of Presidential Swing States, Why Only 10 Matter, Professor David Schultz. David, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
So the report by the House Intelligence Committee should be circling amongst its members today as we speak, before the House Judiciary Committee holds its first hearing on impeachment scheduled for Wednesday. Daniel Lazar, where are we with all of this now?
Where are we? I suppose the whole thing is dragging on step by step. I presume that after we'll have the judiciary hearings on Wednesday, and then sometime shortly thereafter, we'll have a vote in the House, which I assume that the House will vote to impeach. And then it moves to the Senate, which, as you know, is controlled by the Republicans, and it will be a whole new ballgame. And it could be a really wild ballgame, too.
David Schultz, same question to you. The House Judiciary Committee now holds its hearings starting on Wednesday. Where are we with all of this?
Well, I'm not quite sure we're moving maybe as rapidly as everybody thinks. I know a lot of people are speculating a before American Christmas vote by the Judiciary Committee and by the entire House of Representatives. I actually think the vote's going to occur, if it happens, not until after the first of the year, for two reasons. One is that I always put faith in the fact that Congress moves slower than they intend. And two, that I think if the Democrats want maximum exposure, they don't do it in the United States during the holiday season where people are not paying attention, or as much attention. So I think it gets pushed out further. But I think there's also an interesting dilemma here for the Democrats, that if they do vote to impeach and it goes to the Senate, it's correct. It's a whole different game where Trump gets to sort of, and the Republicans get to control what's going on. And I think this raises a question that someone brought up a few weeks ago. Would the Democrats be smarter to do a censure as opposed to an impeachment? And I'm wondering if that's going to be an issue that they start to think about over the next few weeks.
Well, Professor Schultz, this shows your utter brilliance, because that statement takes me right to my next question.
I don't know if it's brilliance, maybe it's just luck.
Daniel Lazar, is censure a viable alternative to impeachment, or will that fail with the Republicans as well?
Well, I mean, I think that censure would be a very good way out of the Democrats' dilemma. It would allow them to show their condemn Trump's sort of strange activities in the Ukraine regarding Giuliani's investigations. It would drive the point home. It would avoid all the trouble they're almost certain to get into in the Senate. So it would make a great deal of sense. And therefore, for that reason, I assume they will not do it, because the Democrats are just condemned to do the wrong thing. They are self-condemned to make every mistake in the book, to sort of play into Trump's hands. And for that reason, I think they will vote. They will go the impeachment route. They will vote to impeach and hand the ball over to the Senate, where there should be a real carnival should take place.
Carnival followed by a circus. David Schultz, I come to you with the same question, and I add to the question again: is censure a viable alternative to impeachment? But I think to Daniel's point, Do the Democrats really want to go down this rabbit hole in the Senate with their threatening to call Hunter Biden and possibly Joe Biden as witnesses?
Yeah, and I agree in the sense that I think the Democrats would be foolish to take that move. Whether they control themselves, I don't know. Remember, initially, Speaker Pelosi didn't want to go the impeachment route, and she was sort of goaded in that direction by her party and by her base. Let's imagine a scenario, just briefly here. Let's say that the Democrats do a censure and don't do an impeachment, and assume also that the president doesn't participate, you know, as he said he's not going to, or his lawyers are not going to participate in the impeachment inquiry. From a political perspective, in some ways, the Democrats get the last word. They get to say what he did was really bad. They have an out by saying it's bad, but it doesn't deserve him to be removed. President doesn't participate, doesn't get his views in, and they keep the Senate from bringing on Biden and so forth. Politically, that would be a really smart move. Again, I'm not sure they can pull that off. But if I were waving my magic wand, that would be what I would tell them to do, because you're right. It's going to be circus carnival. I'm not sure what other event I can come up with to describe what the Senate could very well turn out to be.
Daniel, is it possible that Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi could go to Lindsey Graham and Mitch McConnell and say, okay, guys, let's cut a deal. Give us censure. Mitch, release enough senators to where censure passes, and we can pass censure. Everybody, for the most part, can get what they want, and we all go away at Christmas singing Christmas carols. Well, Chuck Schumer won't sing Christmas carols, but you get my point.
Yes, but I don't think McConnell will go along with that. I think the Democrats will have to be satisfied with a censure vote in the House alone.
Okay.
Which, of course, carries much, much less weight than the censure vote by the entire Congress. I can't imagine McConnell will go along with that. His base would just, you know, lynch him from the nearest tree. And so I think that would not work. The Democrats should cut their losses. Impeachment is not working well. There was an Emerson College poll which found that Trump's approval rating rose 5 points after the impeachment hearings and before the Intelligence Committee.
Hence Trump's tweet, the Republican Party has never been so united. He sees this as galvanizing his base and the Republican Party.
Exactly. And then the more the Democrats hold hearings, presumably the more this trend will continue. And so the Democrats will wind up shooting themselves in both feet and probably some other appendages as well. So if the Democrats were smart, they would cut their losses. They'd go for a censure vote in the House. But their base won't allow that. The base wants them to go the whole nine yards. They want an impeachment vote in the House, and they want to see a trial in the Senate. So and that will end up disastrously, because the Republicans will have full subpoena power. They have a whole list of people they want to subpoena. You know, Hunter Biden, Joe Biden, first and foremost. But the list is endless. They could keep this circus going for months. And they can have the Republicans, you know, writhing in agony the longer it goes on. So it just doesn't make any sense at all. And it's going to end very badly for the Democrats.
And the brilliant Daniel Lazar takes me, David, to my next question, which is, it's great how you guys are doing this. Have the Democrats overplayed their hand here? David Schultz.
It looks like they have right now. I mean, they really haven't, I think, captured the American public's attention that this is like a serious problem that deserves removal from office. Now, there are a lot of people who are going to say what the president's done wasn't smart, wasn't very good, et cetera, but going the full direction of impeachment just hasn't worked very effectively for them, especially as they're framing it solely on the president's phone call with Ukraine. Now, maybe the House Judiciary, I'm just sort of speculating here, maybe the House Judiciary, if they want to expand it a little bit further and try to make the argument in saying that putting pressure on Ukraine and lying about it is worse than having sex with an intern and lying about it, i.e. what Clinton did, maybe they can get somewhere on that. But remember, Bill Clinton came out of that impeachment vote and trial more popular than he went in. So I'm skeptical that the Democrats can come up with anything good short of saying at the end of the day that we reviewed it, it's all bad, all that requires is a censure. You're right. We're not going to get the Republicans to go along with it, but at some point the Democrats need to sort of get what they can get out of it, and what's the old expression in America, and get out of Dodge quickly.
Daniel, one of the witnesses that they're threatening to call is Adam Schiff. And we know that there is some great inconsistency between Adam Schiff's statements about not knowing the identity of the whistleblower, not having spoken to the whistleblower, his saying that a number of times during the hearings. And there are those on the Republican side that want to get him under oath to get him to swear to that, which many then would believe he's perjured himself. But to that point, you just published a piece in weeklyworker.co.uk entitled "The Most Dangerous Woman in America." You consider the role of Fiona Hill in the anti-Trump impeachment campaign. Why do you consider Fiona Hill to be one of the most dangerous women in America?
Well, I mean, first of all, she was very good. Her testimony, she was the woman who testified last week before the House Intelligence Committee and made a brilliant performance. She was crisp, forceful, highly intelligent, extremely effective. And for all those reasons, she's all the more dangerous. Her argument, in essence, was that there is little doubt that the Russians interfered in 2016. And why is there little doubt? Because the intelligence agencies tell us so. And anybody who questions that is doing the work of the Kremlin. Now, that is an extraordinarily dangerous line of argument, especially since Attorney General Bill Barr is now investigating how this whole Russiagate fiasco arose, and he will very likely criticize the role of the intelligence agencies and the FBI, find fault with their methodology. But nevertheless, Fiona Hill's argument was lapped up eagerly by the Democratic members of the House Intelligence Committee, and her argument is dangerous because essentially it is a vehicle for further confrontation with Russia, and this confrontational mood is getting really out of hand.
And I found it very interesting. I agree with you. Her performance was stellar, but she offered no evidence. All she did was just repeat the common narrative that just about everybody wants to run with. And if I am thinking about the same report, the intelligence reports that she is referring to, even within those reports, they said they were inconclusive.
Yes. And the Mueller report itself, first of all, is hardly exempt from criticism. And number two is, to my mind, filled with contradictions and soft spots and holes, et cetera, and unwarranted conclusions. So there's plenty to quarrel with in the Mueller report. There's plenty to pick apart and analyze. And her kind of blanket statement that we must reach this conclusion because the intelligence agencies tell us to is not only absurd but extremely dangerous.
Professor David Schultz, your thoughts.
Well, I think she was powerful in the sense that I know we're talking about how the Democrats reacted, but think about how the Republicans reacted to her talk. And for the most part, the Republicans lacked a counter narrative that was able to, I think, seriously question her. And what I think I'm hitting at here is if we think back to the old days in America, during the Cold War, there was this powerful bipartisan consensus, for good or for bad, regarding how the United States approached the Soviet Union, which sort of held the two parties at least at bay from open conflict with one another, that what she was able to do was effectively tap into that. And she also, I think, made it difficult for Republicans to respond to her because she was, in some sense, hitting at this underlying fear or distrust of Russia, again, for good or for bad, and I leave that to others to debate here. And so I think the Republicans walked out of her testimony not quite sure what to say. And what now, is it 2 weeks later or 10 days later, however since she testified, there still is not a credible, let's say, Republican counter response to what she had to say.
And I think that her narrative serves both parties in some instances for different reasons.
Yes.
But at the end of the day, the United States needs a boogeyman. The United States needs a foe. And so you can take North Korea, you can take Russia, you can take Syria. I mean, we are traversing the globe, creating a number of them. And I would say much to our disservice and to my dismay. Daniel Lazar, Professor David Schultz, gentlemen both, thank you for your time. That I thought was some incredible analysis, as always, and really looking forward to having the both of you back.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, President Trump is to hit Brazil and Argentina with steel and aluminum tariffs. Donald Trump will reimpose tariffs on imports of steel and aluminum from Brazil and Argentina after accusing the countries of a, quote, massive devaluation, end quote, of their currencies that hurt U.S. farmers. The move, which was announced by Trump on Twitter today, sharply escalates trade tensions with the two struggling Latin American economies as they have built closer ties with China. What's going on here? Well, for insight, we turn to my next guest. First, she is one of the Latin American campaign coordinators with Code Pink, Terry Madison. Terry, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
We're also joined by a man with a PhD in political economy. He teaches economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California and is the author of the new book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Jack, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
And let me just quickly say to the audience, I'm about three quarters of the way through your book, and it is phenomenal. Great work, Jack. I can't recommend it enough.
Thank you.
So, Terry, let's start with what's going on here as Trump is hitting Brazil and Argentina with steel and aluminum tariffs?
Well, my understanding is that, first of all, these tariffs were potentially going to be fully implemented in 2018, and then Argentina and Brazil were exempt, and then a quota system was initiated in May of 18. And Jack, please jump in at any moment and correct me if I'm misstating anything here. So there was a cap basically put on aluminum and steel imports from Argentina and Brazil. And now it looks like it's going to be full tariff. But what's curious to me in this story that broke today is that the Trump administration is doing this in response to the apparent devaluation of the real and the peso in Brazil and Argentina, respectively, and that devaluation of the currency is making U.S. farming exports, produce, principally pork and soy beans, I believe, more expensive to import in Argentina and Brazil. And I just wonder how much this has to do in conjunction with the burning of the Amazon, clearing large tracts of the Amazon to expand agricultural industries in Argentina, in Brazil, but also in Bolivia. And Bolivia is not part of today's story. And I just wonder if that has anything to do with the coup on November 10th and, you know, all of that. I may be totally going in the, you know, on a sidetrack here with that. But all three countries have been accused of burning massive tracts of the Amazon to open up space for agribusiness.
Just real quickly, Terry, would the Trump administration want to put pressure on the Bolivian government that it just backed a coup to get it into?
Yeah.
Get it?
Not now.
Okay. 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 That's
not now.
Okay.
Yeah. That's what I believe. That's why it's absent from the conversation.
Okay.
Today.
Dr. Jack Rasmus, your thoughts, sir.
Well, there's several ways of looking at this. First of all, you know, Trump's NAFTA 2.0 UMCA agreement is pretty much dead in the water. It doesn't look like it's going to be passed. So his trade policy has failed there. It looks like the trade policy is dead in the water, at least, and we'll find out in a couple of weeks with China. In other words, even this tepid small agreement with China isn't getting agreed to by China, unless Trump really cuts tariffs, which China is a demand and he's not doing. We'll see. But that looks kind of a tepid agreement, failed on that front. If you look at the steel and aluminum tariffs, they were, you know, among the first tariffs imposed in March 2018. But then Trump immediately exempted 3,500 different steel products. So they were in name only. And now he's saying, well, we're going to actually reinstate steel tariffs. And of course, Brazil is one of the three or four major importers of steel to the U.S. So what he's doing is making it look like he's doing something on trade because his other initiatives are stalled and may fail. As far as steel is concerned, you know, the steel tariffs have resulted in steel prices increasing to 20-25%, but steel jobs under Trump have actually retreated, contracted, declined. So all this talk about, steel, aluminum tariffs are going to bring jobs back is just a lot of nonsense on the part of Trump. So one way of looking at it is, he's doing something somewhere because his other initiatives aren't working. But I think the more important explanation is that the currencies in these economies are collapsing. One of the reasons collapsing is because the global economy is slowing everywhere in the world. And in relative terms, the U.S. economy is slightly better than the rest of the world, although it's joining it soon. So the money is flowing out of these countries, dollars are flowing out of these countries into the safe haven of the U.S. is what Trump calls the wall of money, which he likes, but really it's a reflection of collapsing currencies. Now, when currencies collapse, as they are in Argentina, Brazil, and throughout Latin America now, what that means is that Brazil, a steel producer, becomes more competitive to the U.S. steel companies. The same thing in producing wheat in Argentina or soybeans in Brazil. They become more competitive, and U.S. businesses may lose business to that competition. But even more important than the export advantage, I think, is the fact that U.S. multinational companies throughout Latin America, and they've really penetrated Latin America under neoliberalism here, when they try to repatriate their profits earned in Brazilian real and in Argentine peso, they lose money because the dollar is worth more and that currency is falling, you know, in those mm-hmm. countries. So
right.
when they try to repatriate, they got to buy more dollars and they lose money, you see. So he's protecting U.S. multinational corporations throughout Latin America. He's also sending a signal to China with the negotiations that, look, you're trying to buy more Brazilian soybeans. No, we can do this and that. And it's a response to a problem he's created in encouraging the collapse of the global economy. So it's Trump's policy that he's now trying to offset.
Terry, I want to pick up on Jack's point about the relationship with China, because as a result of the so-called trade negotiations or the trade war, China moved its soy contracts and some of its pork and beef contracts to Brazil and Argentina. And so how about the part of this story that says that Trump's tariffs on imports also have to do with trade tensions as these Latin American economies are building closer ties with China?
I would argue that it isn't just the Trump administration. And I think, you know, Jack's book is so perfectly written about neoliberalism across the globe. But really, we are seeing a collapse of this policy throughout this hemisphere. I can't speak, you know, to other parts of the world. You know, my experiences are here in the Americas. But the takeover of resources and production by transnational corporations has been coming for a number of years throughout the hemisphere. 2009 in Honduras, for example, the coup in June of 2009 put into place massive privatization throughout the country, and not just of natural resources, but of public institutions as well. And you're seeing that model being pushed throughout Central and South America. And one of the things that some of these progressive to leftist governments have attempted to do is embrace multilateralism as a pushback to this U.S. unilateral transnational model. And yes, they are embracing China, and China is embracing them. So that's a big part, at least from my, you know, experiences on the ground, that's a big part of what's playing out. And so it is in its currencies, its imports, its exports, its massive, this attempt to massively privatize natural resources and public institutions, you know, with this U.S. neoliberal model. And Jack speaks beautifully to that in his book.
Go ahead, Jack, and pick up there.
Well, you know, the tariff wars, Trump's tariff wars, and the currency wars are inextricably linked together. Trump raises tariffs while the U.S. dollar remains stronger than these other currencies, and these other currencies collapse or decline, which offsets his tariffs, which requires him to raise more tariffs. You see, he's stuck in his tariff currency cycle here. And even in China, China is intervening to protect its currency from declining, but the dollar is pushing down the yuan, just as it's pushing down the peso and the and the Brazilian real and so forth. That's causing capital flight out of Latin America, which then these business administrations in Latin America raise interest rates, which causes recessions and depressions, which causes the blow up now of popular resentment and resistance. It's all part of the economic pressures that have been building in Latin America that Trump has exacerbated. And then, of course, his puppet regimes there, Macri that was in Argentina and Bolsonaro, you know, they go along with this because they skim off the top and get a big cut of this. But the rest of the people in Latin America pay the price.
Terry, in terms of the rest of the people paying the price, give us some real analysis and insight into how this hits the feet on the street.
Well, they can't afford to buy anything. I mean, food, medicines, nothing. You can't send your kids to school. You can't afford gas to get yourself to work. You can't afford fuel to get your produce to market. It just cripples, you know, working class people, well, everyone actually, but principally, you know, the more vulnerable people, working class and more vulnerable sectors of society. One of the things that's been playing out for a couple months now is, you know, the people in the streets in Chile, in Santiago. And Chile was the first really overt experiment in neoliberal capitalism in the Americas with the Allende coup in 1973. And the people there are in the streets because they simply have had enough. They cannot afford to go to school. The students can't afford to pay tuition to go to school. You can't affordably buy food products, housing. It's really, as much as it, as neoliberalism was touted to bring people out of poverty, in my experience, I've seen nothing but it create poverty. And, you know, it prices people out of participating in the economy on all levels for all types of resources. And it's, you know, we're talking about Brazil and Argentina today with tariffs and devaluation of currency. But just look at what the people have been saying to Pineda in Chile and to the rest of the world for the last several months. I mean, the experiment really started there, and it just doesn't work.
Jack, we have just about a minute and a half. Your thoughts on how this ties directly to your book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump.
Well, once again, the collapsing currencies, result in these local governments that are tied to the U.S. It results in import inflation, and these countries import like 30-40% of their foodstuffs and medicines and so forth. So prices go through the roof when the currency declines. At the same time, the response is businesses with a declining currency, including U.S. corporations, take their money out of these countries, send it to the U.S., right? To stop it, these countries raise interest rates and cause a recession. So you got recessions and you got rising import prices, and that puts tremendous pressure on everybody else except the elites, the corporate elites, who protect themselves by moving their money to America, to the U.S. So everybody else is impacted, and particularly young people. You know, we have this phenomenon worldwide of a breakout of these mass demonstrations. It's because millennials, people under 35, are really bearing the brunt of these policies, and it's really causing an unsustainable standard of living and condition, so they have nothing to do but hit the streets.
Let me thank you both, Terry Madison with Code Pink, Dr. Jack Rasmus, the scourge of neoliberalism, U.S. policy from Reagan to Trump. Thank you both for your time today. Your analysis was incredible, as always, and look forward to having you back.
Thank you so much.
All right, folks. You are tuned to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Beijing retaliates against Trump's signing of Hong Kong Act. China will no longer allow U.S. Navy ships to visit Hong Kong in a retaliatory move after President Trump signed legislation supporting protesters in the territory of Hong Kong. And Secretary of State Pompeo warns Europe against letting Chinese tech giants build 5G networks. For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's an associate professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, Dr. Linwood Taheed. Linwood, as always, welcome back.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
So the Chinese Foreign Ministry said that it would suspend U.S. Navy port calls to Hong Kong, which must receive approval from Beijing. It also pledged to impose sanctions on four U.S.-based non-governmental organizations, including Human Rights Watch and Freedom House, for what it said was their support for violent protests in Hong Kong. You know, I thought we were on the verge of signing a trade deal with the Chinese, and it just seems to me that at too many turns, the president wants to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory.
Exactly. One of the things to think about is why would the president sign a bill that's recognizing the democratic rights of people in Hong Kong against China when, in fact, he's trying to do the opposite here? What's also surprising, of course, is that the Senate passed this bill. This bill was passed by the House some time ago. But the Senate also passed a bill, which means that McConnell let it go to a vote. And that seems to be some collusion, if we want to use that term, between McConnell and Trump, for Trump to sign the bill knowing that the Chinese would retaliate and probably maybe hoping that it would sabotage the trade talks that are going to come up, in which Trump was probably not expecting to come out victorious. So I'm agreeing with you that I think this was an attempt to sabotage the coming trade talks. But apparently it's not working, because the Chinese have not overreacted to this. I mean, what they've done is put sanctions on a couple of NGOs, human rights NGOs, which the Trump administration could care nothing about. And then also restricted access to a couple of Chinese ports for a couple of U.S. Navy ships, which is not very much of a restriction, since those Navy ships can go to other ports in the area.
So this, to me, could demonstrate that, to your point, that China is being very measured, that they've been able to isolate or to silo these issues and really not come down too heavy-handed on the legislative side to jeopardize the trade deal.
Yeah, I think China absolutely wants to get into a trade deal, because in all of the previous deals, the Chinese have come out with the best side of the bargain. And so they're looking for an opportunity to sit down with Trump again and outdeal him. And I think the Trump administration, well, maybe not Trump himself, because I think he's too much of an egoist to think that he would actually be beat. But I think his aides are attempting to sabotage this trade deal.
Oh, but Dr. Tahid, Donald Trump told us on the campaign trail that Barack Obama was stupid and Bill Clinton was stupid and America is stupid and he's not going to be this dumb and he's not going to allow the Chinese to come in here and just out-negotiate because he understands the art of the deal unlike anyone else. So he's not about to get played by the Chinese.
That's what he said. He said trade wars are easy to win.
Right.
You know, he also said that.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. Well, with that now having been said, Pompeo warns Europe against letting Chinese tech giants build 5G networks. He warned today against European countries allowing companies with Chinese links from constructing 5G networks across the continent ahead of a global technology conference, which is about to take place. What I found interesting, in an op-ed for Politico Europe, he urged leaders to put security first when it comes to the construction of 5G networks. He spoke specifically about Huawei, and he said that Huawei is implicated in espionage in the Czech Republic, Poland, and the Netherlands, has allegedly stolen intellectual property from foreign competitors in Germany, Israel, the UK, and the United States, and is accused of bribery and corrupt practices in countries like Algeria, Belgium, and Sierra Leone. So let's see. We've got an accusation, we've got an allegation, and we've got an implication. But other than that, he seemed to offer no, what I will call, evidence.
Well, your listeners remember that, you know, Huawei was involved in some national security issues with the U.S. military. U.S. military personnel were using Huawei phones around the world. And there was some concern that was raised about the Chinese being able to put tracking devices and other types of
other backdoor
devices in the phones.
Right.
Right. And so, that's something that came about not that long ago in the Trump administration, that there were calls to restrict military personnel from using Huawei phones. Now, the Huawei and phones and other Chinese made phones and computerized devices have been in use in the U.S. for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Unless we're being naive, we might conclude that the Chinese government would want to surveil U.S. personnel and U.S. Citizens and businesses by the use of backdoors on these electronic instruments. So the idea that the Chinese would use these for espionage is probably well-founded. On the other hand, Pompeo is going to Europe to ask them to not use 5G, Huawei 5G technology, when U.S. companies are going full speed in using Huawei 5G technology. And that's because Huawei has a complete 5G system as opposed to other developers, which might only have a piece of the system. So Pompeo would do well to talk to American CEOs about not using Huawei 5G technology and let the Europeans take care of their own security.
I want to say it was during the first Obama administration that a big issue with Huawei came up because Huawei routers, say that fast five times, were integral part of the United States intelligence infrastructure. And people were just aghast at, oh my goodness, we have a Chinese company that has a very important part of United States intelligence infrastructure, data transmission.
Correct. And so this is not a new revelation that Chinese manufacturers might be involved in espionage in the U.S. There's a kind of a related issue. I used to be in the software business, and it always amused me that if you remember Kaspersky Labs, which was the producer of antivirus software, Russian-owned company, had contracts with the U.S. government and U.S. military to provide antivirus software for computer systems. Later found out that Kaspersky was, as a Russian government entity, was spying on U.S. companies and military. So the idea that foreign companies, particularly, for example, in Russia and China, might use their products for espionage in the U.S. is not a new thing. It's been around for a while.
But to that point, we also have to recognize that Israel has been accused and found guilty of spying on the United States. And we also know that the United States is not adverse to spying on its allies and its perceived enemies as well. So, I mean, one of the things that just is so amusing to me, if it weren't so nauseating, is the hypocrisy behind America's hand-wringing and outrage that other countries are doing things that I would say they're just taking the pages out of the U.S. playbook.
Yes, you raise a very good point. And with Pompeo going to European government saying, don't use Chinese technology, I suppose there would be an alternative. That might be U.S. technology. And why would the Europeans think that U.S. technology would also not carry the same national security risk for European countries?
Oh, because we're the good guys. Because, Linwood, we're the good guys. That's why.
Well, I mean, that's the propaganda. Of course, it's not believed in Europe, and it's certainly not believed in China or Russia. So you know, Pompeo again would be better being a Secretary of State as opposed to a foreign diplomat talking to the Europeans about national security, with the Europeans knowing that probably the greatest threat to their national security is nationalism as it's being exported by the Trump administration to their countries.
Dr. Linwood Taheed, as always, sir, thank you so much for your time today. I greatly, greatly appreciate it and your analysis, and look forward to having you back.
Thank you, sir. It's been a pleasure.
All right, folks. You've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.